Hello and welcome to Fresh Heart Stories. I'm Dr. Zareen Sheikh and I'm delighted to welcome Ricky Kapoor, who has so generously agreed to share his story on this episode. Ricky was born in Glasgow and he was just 6 years old when his father suddenly passed away, leaving Ricky, his mother and his two siblings. Ricky was later diagnosed with a condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a genetic condition that affects the muscle of the heart, making the walls of the heart chambers thicken. The left ventricle, one of the four chambers that pumps blood out of the heart, is almost always affected. Sometimes the right ventricle becomes thickened too. For some, it makes it harder for the heart to pump blood out. And if this happens, it's called hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. For most people, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy doesn't have a big impact on life. Some don't have symptoms. Ricky is one of a small number of people for whom it is more serious and who are at risk of developing life-threatening abnormal heart rhythms. For this reason, he was fitted with an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, or an ICD. An ICD is a small device that monitors the heart for abnormal, dangerous heart rhythms, and if it detects them, then it can deliver pacing impulses or a shock to prevent sudden cardiac death. The diagnosis wasn't easy for Ricky. He was a competitive athlete and had to stop most of the activities that he loved doing. In this podcast, he discusses his diagnosis, the changes he had to make, and how he not only came to terms with them, but learnt to thrive. Here's his story. Please note, this interview was recorded before the lockdown restrictions. Ricky Kapoor, welcome to the Fresh Heart Podcast. We're so excited to have you here today, so thank you.
Not at all. Great to be
here. I really wanted you to come on this podcast because we met a couple of months ago, didn't we?
Yes,
at a mutual friends party. And I overheard you talking in the kitchen to someone and saying, oh, I've got a cardiac condition. And obviously that sparked my interest and I felt like I had to come over and ask you about it, being a cardiologist. And what really struck me is that you talked about your cardiac condition, which is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and gave me such a unique insight into living with it, which we don't often get as doctors and as cardiologists. And not only that, I had a really inspirational conversation with you about living life and living life to the full. And I just felt I have to get you onto the podcast because this message is something that will resonate not only with people with cardiac conditions, but with people without cardiac conditions. Yeah. So thank you very much, Ricky Kapoor. I'm very excited to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Ricky, we're going to start off talking a little bit about your childhood in Glasgow. You grew up just outside Glasgow.
Yes,
is that
right? Yeah. Before I moved down here, I spent 30 years in Glasgow. Grew up, went to school, just lived a normal life as anyone would until I was diagnosed at 18 years old.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually have an operation to have a cardioinverter.
Yeah.
Effectively an internal defibrillator fitted until I was 26. So,
right.
You know, I went 8 years without actually realizing the dangers. Because if I look back now, I would say it was a danger to myself, and it was probably more of an immaturity thing, not realizing and not really making full use of people like your cardiologist, your cardiomyopathy nurse that you actually have, who are specialists in the area, to get more knowledge about the actual condition. My family does have a history of cardiomyopathy. My father passed away with it and his granddad passed away with it. And it was only until I was diagnosed that my mum then started to make further inquiries and just really finding out, one, about the condition, and two, who else does it affect in the family?
Absolutely.
Because nobody else has come to us and said to us, you know, you could be a carrier or you could have this condition.
Yeah.
So it was more my mum doing the work than me, myself,
because
I knew my mum was actually doing it anyway. So I didn't really get too involved in it until I was actually sat down probably at about 25 with my cardiologist nurse and my cardiologist, who is now retired, Dr. Ian Finlay, who is quite a renowned cardiologist within the UK. And he actually did say, you know, now's the time that you should actually think about not just yourself, but also your family. And I think that resonated with me.
Yeah.
Because it's not about myself. The condition isn't about myself, because your family's actually been impacted it once before with my father. So, you know, I think that hit home at that point more than anything.
How old were you when your father died?
6 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was only 42 when he passed away.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how was that for you as a family growing up?
Different. It was different because you didn't have that father figure there. Your mum was your dad. It's very different. You know, my mum, she tried her very best. You know, it's not like she can take us to football games, because there were three of us. Give her her dues and give her her credit, which I wholeheartedly do. She used to take us everywhere. You know, if I had football training, if my brother had swimming training, my sister had some sort of, you know, she used to do dancing quite a lot as well. She would make time out of nothing to make sure that we did what we needed to do. And there were always things that that probably pushed the boundaries a little as well, and she wasn't able to do them. But it wasn't the fact that she wasn't able to do them, it's the fact that it's just she's a single person and one person can only do so much.
Absolutely.
But over the course of, you know, I think as we grew up, as we became teenagers, I think, you know, that burden on her certainly, you know, reduced as we took more responsibility on. And it just makes you think about yourself and your family more. And I think that's exactly what, you know, that's what resonated with me, is the fact that, you know, my cardiologist wasn't saying this condition isn't just about you.
Yeah.
It's about all the other people it's going to affect. Yeah. Yeah. Not now, but possibly in a year's time, 2 years, 10 years time, 15 years time, when you've got a family to look after as well, you've got to think about them.
Yeah. And you were quite sporty as a child, weren't you?
Yeah, so talk me through. I used to play football probably about four times a week, generally with friends, but I also used to play in a football team every Saturday morning, which my mum used to take me to every Saturday. And I also used to do a lot of cross-country running at high school. So when I was actually diagnosed, they didn't know whether it was just because of the athleticism, and it was the fact that possibly you could just have an enlarged ventricle because of the amount of sport that you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's what they, I think that's what they hoped it would be. My life as a child, I think, couldn't have been better. You know, I got to do everything I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, all right, it was without one parent, but I got to do everything I wanted to do, whether that be, you know, going to sporting events, doing things with my friends, and just generally, you know, just making sure that, you know, I was happy. Which, you know, as a child, I think that's the only one thing you want to think about is your own happiness. And it just makes, I think, you know, for me, you know, if anyone said, you know, how was your childhood? It was, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Amazing. And that's a real testament to your mother as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think so. You know, she's been someone that's been through the condition.
Yeah.
You know, she knew that my dad did have a condition.
Yeah.
But she was never actually told
what it was.
What the actual prognosis was, what it meant.
Yeah.
So for her, yeah.
Yeah. And tell me, what sort of symptoms, what started happening for you to then seek help before arriving at the diagnosis?
It was more my mum than anything.
Really?
Again. Yeah, it was more my mum than anything, because I think she had us tested when we were very young.
Yeah.
And the doctor said that everything is fine, absolutely everything is fine. And it wasn't till it was very soon after my 18th birthday.
Right.
That I had a normal heart checkup, I had the ECG, I had an ultrasound.
Yeah.
And during the ultrasound, they were concerned because I have hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy.
Yeah.
So that's obviously the left ventricle is slightly larger when they did their calculations of the size of my of my ventricle, they realized it falls into the category of obstructive.
So when they were when you'd had the echo scan and they were concerned, what was going through your head?
I would probably actually say what was going through my head was I wanted to go and play football. I had to miss out going to training, and it was the fact that I was just like, you know, why do I have to do this now? Why can't I do it in my spare time? You know, looking back on it now, you know, it's probably the best thing that ever happened, because you know, my football team was never going to do that for me. I would have needed to do that myself to find out I have the condition myself. So it was, you know, even though my mum dragged me along to get that done, you know, it was the best thing for me at the time.
And when you were then told, yes, you have the diagnosis, you have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, talk me through how you navigated through that process.
Yeah, I think, I mean, during that whole time, I think it was more of a, can I live absolutely fine without taking anything for this?
Yeah.
Do I need to do anything differently?
Yeah.
And that's obviously after the results had come through and they had said that possibly there is some sort of abnormality that we need to do further checks and further tests on. Yeah. And at that point I was like, well, does it stop me from doing this? Does it stop me from playing football? Does it stop me from doing swimming? And at that point, they didn't know the actual answer either themselves.
Yeah.
So they just said that all we want to be sure of is if you get breathlessness, if you get any sort of, you know, chest pains, you immediately call your nurse, you know, and you go straight to A&E because, you know, you've got to take that, you know, you've got to take precautions in these in these instances. So for me, I was looking at those symptoms more than anything else, and saying, well, if that doesn't happen, then I should be okay. You know, do I get breathless? No. I mean, my 30th, you know, since I've been diagnosed for nearly what, the last 18 years I've been diagnosed, I've never got breathlessness. So it doesn't, I would still say it doesn't affect me as much as other people. But what I think back then was very much about, what I was more concerned about was the fact that I wanted to do the stuff I still actually love to do on a daily basis. And it was that train of thinking which I think stopped me from thinking about the other things that possibly I could have done when I was younger, you know, more research and a little bit more reading up on the condition. To find out what it actually meant for me. What they did say was, you know, you can have your, we've now got something in place. That's when they showed me the device, the cardioinverter device, that ICD. So it's, I mean, I think at that point, I think that's when, you know, I kind of, you know, it wasn't as if it was just a light bulb. I think a switch did click with me, and it did say, well, you know, it's probably now the time to do this because, you know, I'm not getting any younger.
Were you still playing sports? What degree, were you
so
still
even
active?
By the time I got to university, still playing football probably about between 2 to 3 times a week. And even at that as well, you know, I'd taken up doing tennis as well. So, you know, just the odd game with a friend playing tennis. But, you know, it's quite an exertive sport, tennis as well, which I probably shouldn't have been doing. But, you know, I think I know that now. You know, you don't realise until you do the research and you do the background, you do the background insights into these things that you realise, I'm actually putting a lot of pressure on my heart, and I might be just playing just with a friend, but it does put it all into perspective that, you know, when you carry such a condition, you have to think about what you're doing as well. Absolutely. Not just do what you're doing and then think about it later.
Exactly. And there's an invincibility, isn't there? You think, oh, it's just not going to happen to me. That's what a sort of mindset in anything.
It's very much that. Like. You know, I think everybody wants to be normal.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that. I don't know if you can call it that, because everyone's an individual and everyone's different. But, you know, nobody wants an organ that has a default in such way. So I think especially with all your friends and everyone in your family is okay. So you just want to be part of that. You don't want to say that you're the odd one out here.
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, my perception on that has, you know, gone completely.
Absolutely.
You know, 180 on that.
So you were in that minority that did actually need a lead, and how did you feel about that when that was explained to you?
Well, they did say to me, you would be a guinea pig.
Did they?
So, because I think I was one of the very first people in Scotland to actually obtain one of them.
Yeah.
Which, when I saw the size of it, I was like, how are you going to fit that inside me? Because it was fairly big.
Yeah.
Compared to the one I have now, you know, nearly 20 years later, is absolutely tiny. It's remarkable that, you know, the same device has changed so much. But, at the end of the day, I agreed to it and I said, okay, I'll have it. But is it going to, I think in the back of my mind, I was thinking, is it going to affect my life that much?
Yeah. You're 26, you've now got an ICD defibrillator in.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, how did you feel about it? Were there any fears?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think for myself, it was more about, you know, here's this device, it's going to be implanted in me. You know, what's it going to stop me doing?
Yeah.
What is it actually, you know, am I still going to be able to do the same things that...
Exactly.
And I was given the indication that I can still lead a normal life and do everything that I wanted. Well, that was up until the first time it actually went off.
Oh.
when I decided to go and play football.
Oh, no.
So, and that was quite a big shock, and not... You know, I'm using that pun here because it did
absolutely
shock me.
But literal shock.
It was literally probably the sorest thing that had ever happened to me in my life.
Right.
Because it felt as if someone had taken a baseball bat
and
then smacked me at the back, like right down my spine.
Jeez.
Because your whole body can feel it.
Yeah.
But it lasted literally not even a second.
Yeah.
And it's quite funny because one of my friends actually said to me, I don't mean to be like rude or anything, however, that you've gone as white as a ghost.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, I think my defibrillator went off.
Oh, wow.
Because...
Were you still standing at this point?
I was still standing at that point because what had happened was the ball was with the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper had kicked it and it had gone over our head. And as I was turning around, I thought the ball may have hit me on the back.
Oh, wow.
But it wasn't because the ball was way down on the other side of the field and there was only the goalkeeper behind me.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, what on earth just happened there? And that was... ICD shock.
How long had you had it in at that point?
I probably had it in about 6 to maybe 7 months, I think, since I had the operation. So
what happened then? So you're on the football pitch, you think it's gone off?
And, well, the game obviously stopped and then one of my friends called an ambulance and I got taken into an ambulance.
Yeah.
And literally I was rushed to A&E and then from A&E, they checked my heart, they did an ECG and they said, everything is absolutely fine. You know, there doesn't seem to be any problems here. But what we want you to do is, you know, phone your cardiomyopathy nurse, get her to test the device as well, because I, at the time as well, it saved all the readings on there, which they couldn't get because the device that I was using is an American device, mm-hmm. and I think only certain hospitals in Glasgow actually had the actual capability to take the readings off it.
Mm.
So they said, you know, make an appointment immediately, just to make sure that the episode that you had won't happen again.
Yeah.
And if it does happen again, then you need to come straight into A&E. And at that point, I was like, this is the end of my football career, right? Yeah. Because all my friends were outside, like literally they'd stopped playing football and they'd all come down to the hospital to make sure that I was okay, because genuinely I don't think any of them wanted anything to happen to me.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that would probably that would probably be one of the hardest things to ever go through if that actually happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, touch wood, I was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And it was just the fact that when the when the actual defibrillator was set up, they didn't set it correctly, that's all. So the heartbeats, I think that they had put them far too low. And as soon as that hit a threshold, it just went off.
Yeah. So that was an inappropriate shock.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a shock that was meant to happen. It just happened because the settings weren't right for you.
Correct.
Yeah. And then they tweaked it. They tweaked the settings.
They tweaked it. They made it. I think they speaking to my nurse and the cardiologist, they increased that. I was still able to do sports, but what they asked me to do at that point was reel it in a little bit. Don't do your overexerting sports, such as, you know, football for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Your tennis. Yeah. You just have to give up. However, you know, if you want to put a monitor on your heart, around your chest, then you can go out for a jog. You can still keep yourself active. You know, you can do walks.
Yeah.
We're not going to stop you from doing physical exercise, but you need to stop things like, you know, if you want to go to the gym, you can do the cross trainer. You can go on the treadmill, but nothing that's going to overexert yourself.
And what was the conversation like between you and your football team after that?
But they completely understood.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't think they can do it. They couldn't do anything else, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it was the fact that, you know, I've played for them for so long and it's now a case of, well, you know, I'm no longer going to be able to. And I found it probably easier to do it to them than to my actual friends.
Really?
Because, you know, you play for so long. Yeah. From primary school into high school.
Yeah.
And you've got the same friends, and then you have to tell them, you know, you can't send me a text, you can't send me a because I'm not going to be able to play football anymore. I think that was harder than actually going to anybody else and saying, you know, I've got a heart condition, because it felt like being excluded from something.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because it wasn't because they were excluding me.
Yeah.
I had to exclude myself from doing it. And I think that's one of the hardest things that you come across.
Yeah.
Is the fact that there will be things that you can't do.
Yeah.
But in the whole grand scheme of things, it's a tiny sacrifice to make. In actual fact. So, you know, you just realise that, you know, life is much bigger than one game of football.
And that's such a powerful message.
It is, I think it is, you know, because most people live for the moment, and most people live for being with their friends and their family, you know, and they don't want to change that. They don't want to change what they've previously done, and being told that you can't do something, I think it definitely makes people just not want to do that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think it's human nature to, if someone tells you not to do something,
that's what you focus on.
Yeah, to actually do it.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting, you know. You know, and I think it takes a lot of courage to turn up and just say, you know, it's not going to affect me.
Yeah. And did that come to you straight away, or was it a real process that you then arrived at?
I think it probably took me a couple of weeks to digest.
Yeah.
I think it probably did. You know, I think psychologically, for me, I was probably in a good place anyway.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I was at university at that point. I'd finished university, I was in my job at that point, and I was quite happy as a person and, you know, doing what I was doing. So there wasn't anything there, if you were to say, I'm going to take this away from you.
Yeah.
That, for me, was going to be a huge, it was going to have a huge impact on me. So for me to say that, I think it took me a couple of weeks to digest and then actually realise, well, on the grand scheme of everything, it's a very small thing to give up.
That's amazing. That's amazing that it took a couple of weeks for you to reconcile that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think my family helped more than anything in that, because, you know, my sister's a doctor as well.
Really?
So, yeah, you know, you have your sibling chats and, you know, I think as well, because she's very aware of the condition.
Yeah.
Very aware of the condition. Yeah. So she just makes sure that it's, you know, something that I always keep my eye on as well. And she likes to talk about it as well, just to make sure that, you know, what I'm doing isn't overexerting myself, or what I'm doing isn't going to affect me.
Yeah.
Because I've started something that's new that I shouldn't be doing.
That's amazing.
So she always just likes to keep, you know, tabs and checkups on me as well.
Yeah.
So it's nice because, you know, I guess to have someone in the medical field, okay, she's a GP. Yeah. But she knows a lot about it because of the family history.
And that's just a lovely segue into talking about relationships and talking about the effect that it's had on, you know, your relationships with your family, with girlfriends, with, you know, your friends.
Yeah.
Have you had anything that
I've never had? I would never say that I've had any negative response to it.
Mm.
But I think, you know, coming from an Asian background, there is a whole load of stigma in and around conditions, especially heart conditions.
Yeah.
You know, my mum is very much, she's very, very well known in the Hindu community in Glasgow. So, and she does say, you know, if I am dating someone, then she will say, have you told them about your heart condition?
Yeah.
You know, it might only be 2 weeks in, and she's telling me, have you told them yet? And I was like, you know, you don't just come out with that kind of stuff straight away.
Yeah.
But it's that mentality of, you know, I think she's quite old fashioned that you need to put all your cards on the table.
Yeah.
And it's, I think my friends, you know, coming from Glasgow and now living in London.
Yeah.
You know, I've made a whole array of new friends as well. And having to tell them much later on, as in, you know, in the present now, that I do have this condition.
Yeah.
I think they're more intrigued than anything.
Yeah.
Because they just really, they I don't think a lot of them have ever had anybody that one has a heart condition, so it's actually quite good to actually educate them about something like that,
and that you just can live with it and you can thrive and you can
and
do well.
You can do pretty much anything you want,
bar
within certain reason. But you know, it's just about that whole education piece with them, and things that I can and I can't do.
Yeah,
and then they get it, and then they want to see the device and touch it.
Yeah,
because it's a real thing. Yeah. So, like, because when you wear a shirt in work, nobody can see it.
You can't tell.
Nobody can see it. But when they touch it,
yeah,
I think that's when it hits them.
Yeah.
Like, that's a real thing
inside
someone's body.
Absolutely.
And it's, yeah, I think, you know, I think it's how you go about it as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about, well, I try to educate people on it rather than saying, I've got this and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you do a little bit more just so that people are aware of it.
Yeah. And what really struck me in our conversation when we first met is your trip to Machu Picchu. tell us about that. Tell us about what happened and what your cardiologist said and then what you ended up
doing. So we had planned to do 3 weeks, myself and my girlfriend planned to do 3 weeks in Peru.
Yeah.
Doing quite a lot of travelling across, you know, I think it was about 8 or 9 different towns.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do Machu Picchu as well. So, yeah. Because Machu Picchu is so high up, it's around about 5,000 metres,
yeah.
Air is very thin.
Yeah.
So the first thing I did was get straight onto the telephone to my cardio.
Absolutely.
My cardiomyopathy nurse and say, I'm going to Machu Picchu. Is yeah. it okay to go there? Because for me, you know, unless I acclimatise, then it could potentially be very difficult because yeah. one, you know, the heart's going to be pumping a lot faster. Two, as well, your heart rate is going to increase with that as well. So I just wanted to be 100% sure that I was allowed to go. And as soon as she heard Machu Picchu, yeah. she was like, that's that mountain in South America. I was like, yeah, that yeah. is. And she was like, I don't think you're allowed to go. And I was like, what? I was like, I'm going. Regardless of whether I'm allowed to climb it, I'm going to Peru.
Yeah.
I'm going to Peru. So she was like, let me speak to the cardiologist.
Yeah.
And they then came onto a conference call with me and they just said, look, if you really, really want to do it, then you can do it, but you're not hiking up
yeah.
Machu Picchu.
Yeah.
You get the train or you get a lift up to Machu Picchu and you effectively then you can see it from that height.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
Because the 4 days of hiking is a gradual hike. So I was trying to reason with them on the phone. Yeah. And they were like, no, because you're going to yeah. be putting yourself under, you know, a lot of stress.
Yeah.
And we don't want your heart to be that stressful at that height. And then on top of that as well, you don't want to have an episode or you don't want to have something yeah. happen to you in those mountains because it's very difficult to get off there as well. So, you know, I tried to reason with them, but they shut me down straight away. So it was just a case of I ended up having to take the train up there. And yeah. then I had, so we had some porters that stayed behind with me
yeah.
and they took me up. So they actually got me on a bus. We went up to about 4,000 metres. Then you have to walk up.
Yeah.
So we walked up the final. The final 1,000 metres or so.
Wow. What was going through your mind?
To be fair, that was okay. I mean, I felt it was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, the steepness of it, if I was to do that for like 6 hours straight,
yeah,
I'd be absolutely shattered.
Yeah.
Because it only took us about an hour
yeah.
to get up there once we started to climb. However, you know, if you were doing, and most of the days they were walking for 6 days, if it was anything like that, yeah. honestly, it would just yeah. be like, I'm giving up now.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was just surreal to get up to the top and be one of the, because we had gone so early, just after 4 a.m.,
yeah.
that the sun started to rise about 6 a.m. when we reached the peak.
Wow.
So we were one of the first people there and it was just unbelievable.
Wow.
Actually unbelievable.
Yeah.
And as the sun comes through, the clouds just start to disappear
yeah.
as it gets lighter and lighter and lighter.
Yeah.
By about 7 o'clock, the clouds just disappeared and it was just, I mean, the actual Machu Picchu mountain itself and everything around it was just yeah. absolutely pristine.
Yeah.
It was just so beautiful.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah. So, Ricky, that's just given us such a wonderful account of living with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, living with having an ICD, some of the challenges, and then also some of the amazing things that you're still able to do.
Yeah.
You know, what I love about your story is the fact that it's not stopped you. You're living your life to the full and you're really, you know, capitalizing on every minute. And what would you say to other people who are going through similar journeys, what is your message to them?
I think it's just really about staying positive, you know,
yeah.
100%, you know, never let an ICD or never let a heart condition dictate you or what you want to do. You know, you need to be able to kind of take control and with that, you then learn new things you know, it's always a learning process, you know, of what you can and you can't do. But always remain positive, because, you know, there is so much support out there for people. And I don't think, and this is, I think, you know, why we want to raise so much awareness about such conditions, is, you know, there are so many different charities. You know, there's not just the British Heart Foundation, but there are so many subsectors of that that go right down to such things as cardiomyopathy associations as well. So you don't have to, you don't have to rely on someone that may not know fully about your condition. And it's just really, you know, I think all about making sure that you yourself are comfortable. Comfortable with your condition, but also comfortable about speaking to about your condition as well. I think it's such a prevalent thing now in the UK, as more and more people are finding out there are silent carriers. There are those who are carriers of the actual gene as well, if it's hereditary. And, you know, to make sure that there is awareness, that people know where to go to get help.
Yeah. And we'll obviously be putting links to lots of organisations that can help in the show notes of the podcast, so please do have a look. Ricky, thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing your story. It's really brave of you to come here, sit down and talk to us about what you've been through. And, you know, it's just such a wonderful story of having difficulties, navigating your way through them, and finding a way to live your life to the full. And I think it's really, I think you know, it's really going to resonate with people out there. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We're so grateful to Ricky for being incredibly generous with his story and his experiences. Remember, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy affects everyone differently. If you've been affected by the discussions in this podcast, please know that help is out there. We've included links to some excellent organisations and resources that provide invaluable support in the episode show notes. If you have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and, like Ricky, want to play sport, travel and pursue outdoor activities, please speak to your cardiologist, who can advise you on your own individual risk. Importantly, this podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your healthcare practitioner. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you have any suggestions, or if you have your own personal story that you would like to share, please do get in touch at Fresh Heart Project on Instagram, at Fresh Heart Proj on Twitter, or via the website freshheartproject.com. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps lead to great change. This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.